Well, as we approach Father's Day this weekend, we come to a most appropriate section of Scripture. For you see, in chapter 11, Paul the Apostle reveals to us that he truly does have the heart of a father. Now, in chapter 5, Paul the Apostle said, of 1 Corinthians, pardon me, chapter 5, you have 10,000 instructors, but you have not many fathers. All kinds of people want to come to you and lay certain trips on you. But Paul said, I have begotten you in the faith. And Paul had the heart of a father towards the Corinthian Christians. And in chapter 11, that is powerfully portrayed. For you see, in verses 1 through 4, we see Paul's jealousy over them. Verse 2, I am jealous over you with a godly jealousy, for I have espoused you to one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. I'm jealous over you, because I want to present you to your bridegroom, Jesus Christ, in a state of purity, as a virgin, you see. And as we pointed out last week, that was the responsibility of a father in the Jewish culture. He was expected and required to make sure that the daughter that he presented in marriage was a virgin. And if her virginity could not be proven, that he, the father, would be humiliated and the lady, the daughter, could be killed, you see. So Paul says, I have this jealousy over you. I want to present you as a father would in the Jewish culture, as a virgin at that marriage feast of the Lamb, when I usher you into the presence of your bridegroom, Jesus Christ. So he talks about this jealousy over them in verses 1 through 4. And then as a father, in verses 5 through 11, he shares his generosity with them. How he came and was not putting trips financially upon them, wasn't charging them, but just being generous with himself, with his energy, with his time, you see. Giving all he had and taking nothing from them to be a burden upon them financially. He was just generous with them, and we talked about that in our study last time as well. A father, it is said, is someone who carries photographs where his money used to be. If you're a dad, you get the picture. And here Paul says, this is what I did, man. I wasn't charging you. In fact, I was drawing from other churches. Verse 8, taking wages from them to support me that I wouldn't be a burden upon you, you see. So he talks in verses 5 through 11 about his generosity with them. So, this father's heart, Paul, his jealousy over them as a protective father, protecting their purity. His generosity with them, not wanting to burden them but to bless them. And finally, verses 12 through 28, the section we'll look at tonight, we see his anxiety about them. He really cares. He's not just coming in as an instructor academically, but he's anxious. And the word there that he will use concerning his care is a pressure, a burden. He feels intensely wanting them to do well, you see. So, let's talk about that. Let's see Paul as a father to the Corinthian congregation expressing his concern, his anxiety about them. We left off there showing that others were coming and burdening the Corinthians by charging exorbitant rates and wages for their instruction, their teaching. They are false apostles, verse 13, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. Now, Paul, up to this time, has been sort of kind in the way that he's talked about these guys that have come on the scene, challenging Paul's authority. Those that have come on the scene, being a burden upon the Corinthian Christians. But now, hey, this is where he gets in their face. They're false apostles. They're deceitful. They're transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ, but in reality, man, they're bogus. They're counterfeit. And no marvel, verse 14. For Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Don't be surprised when these false teachers, these false instructors come and they seem to live so righteously. Their standards seem to be so moral. They stress family living. They talk about caring for their own community, separating themselves from the defilement of the world. And it has a tremendous appeal. The commercials that they air, many of these cults. Man, they're warm and fuzzy and they sound so right. And you go, wow, this is light. This is light. Even their temple in Salt Lake City, it glows, you see. And so often, the cults seem to be bathed in light. Paul says, don't marvel at this. Satan himself transforms into an angel of light. See, Satan will go either way with a person. If a person wants to be dark and devilish and AC/DC, Black Sabbath-y, fine. He'll meet them there. He'll suck them in. He'll titillate their sensuality. He'll play that game with them. But if somebody else wants to be righteous, prudish, American, then he'll meet them there, you see, as an angel of light, saying, you don't need to admit that you're a sinner and need a Savior. Just live righteously. Family values. The GOP. Rush Limbaugh. Be a ditto head. That's good enough. You see. He'll meet people anywhere they want to go to keep them away from the truth, which is, I'm a sinner, I need a Savior, Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God who died for me, and now I want Him to take up residency within me. He is the Lord. But you see, Satan will say, you don't need to be that kind of fanatic. You don't need to spend your time in Bible study. And he'll transform himself into an angel of light. Now, interesting to me, because all of these so-called spiritual people that talk about what lies beyond, whether it's Dr. Raymond Moody or Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, they tell how interesting that anyone who is a good moral person, whether they're a Buddhist, a Christian, a Mormon, a Republican, whoever it might be, anyone who's a good moral person, when they are at the door of death, they all have a common experience. They see a warm, bright light. And those that have come back from those near-death experiences, those that have been at the door of death, perhaps even the instruments in the operating room show that they had died for a minute or two or whatever it might be. They'll come back and they'll tell stories that are amazingly consistent. That is, I saw my whole life race before me. And then I saw this beautiful, bright, warm light. And Dr. Raymond Moody and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and others that we read about that make a name in this kind of thing are implying that all good people, no matter what your belief system is, every good person sees this light. And the implication being, so just be a good person. And whatever route you choose, you'll all make it to the bright light at the end of the tunnel. But wait. That bright light at the end of the tunnel may not be the Father of Lights, God. It may be the one who transforms himself to appear as an angel of light. That bright light at the end of the tunnel may be a train coming down the track to run you down. Truly, Paul the Apostle says, don't be fooled. Satan himself transforms into an angel of light. Does that mean that he really is? No. And be careful about those who write about these near-death experiences and the implications they make. When somebody says, well, you know, I'm not a born-again believer like you guys are preaching, but man, I almost died and I saw this light, and so I know I'm okay. Say, hey, you might be on the wrong track. That light might be coming to do you in, not take you home. Well, so if Satan transforms himself into an angel of light, verse 14, it is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works. They might appear righteous, they might wear holy underwear or backwards collars, or they might shave their heads and wear robes and walk piously with sort of a glazy smile on their lips. And you might go, ooh. And they'll say, om. And this is such deep spirituality. Let's just ponder what they're saying. Certainly they have truth, you see. Paul says, their end, though, shall be according to their works. Now, what does that mean? Master, what must we do to do the works of God? They asked him in John chapter 6. And Jesus said, this is the work of God. One thing, that you believe on him whom the Father hath sent. The question people are always asking, that the omers are attempting to answer, the door knockers, the backwards collarers, or whoever they might be, what must we do to do the works of God? We'll just om, or join our temple and be baptized. Whatever it might be, no. This is the work of God. One thing, Jesus said, not works plural, but work singular, that you believe on him whom the Father hath sent. It's a free gift. And anything you add to that only brings corruption and pollution to the beautiful plan of salvation. I don't care how incensey it might smell. I don't care how glorious it might seem. Or stimulating it might be. If a person is adding anything to the simple believing on him whom the Father hath sent, then they are on dangerous ground. So it's going to be according to their works. What's their works? Well, they'll be judged according to their human activity, their human effort. And guess what? everybody who's judged in that way is going to fail miserably. I'm glad that I'm not judged according to my works. Boy, it would be terrible. I say again, verse 16, let no man think me a fool, if otherwise, yet as a fool receive me. Don't think me a fool, but if you do, listen anyway. I like that. That I may boast myself a little, that which I speak it not after the Lord, but as it were foolishly in this confidence of boasting. Oh, listen, I know you think I'm foolish. If that's the case, so be it. But I'm going to have to boast a bit here, Paul says. I'm embarrassed about it. But because you're questioning my authority, because you're questioning my credentials as an apostle, I'm going to have to boast. But look what he says here, gang. I like this. I'm going to have to do this boasting. That which I speak, verse 17, it not after the Lord. Now, don't blame the Lord for my boasting. I like that. I've got to do this, but don't blame the Lord. Interesting that Paul was careful here to say, you're forcing me to share this, but don't blame the Lord for what's happening, because I'm embarrassed about it. So often, in things of the Spirit, the Lord gets blamed. You hear about the latest thing that's going through a lot of the Pentecostal churches, this holy laughter? I've heard it. And laughter is sort of a contagious kind of thing. I understand that phenomena. But in the middle of the Bible study or the prayer meeting or whatever, everybody will just start laughing. And it just kind of spreads, and they're laughing and they're rolling in the... Literally, I'm not kidding. That's not... They're really rolling around in laughter and holding their belly. And they call it just... this is the latest manifestation of the Spirit. So in the middle of a Sunday teaching or whatever it might be, somebody will start laughing and, don't blame me, brother, it's the Spirit. What a joke. Because, you see, it's happening. Because, you see, Paul made it very clear, didn't he, in 1 Corinthians when he talked about the manifestations, he says, hey, the spirit of the prophet is subject unto the prophet. In other words, the person who's exercising prophecy or any manifestation is in control. And it's lunacy and it's an embarrassment to the Christian community when people do bizarre things and then say, well, it was just the Lord coming upon me. I couldn't help it. I was out of control. I really questioned that. And Paul seems to go out of his way here to say, now, in this boasting, don't blame the Lord. Now, don't blame the Lord. I'm going to do this, but don't blame him. I like that. Going out of his way, not to blame the Lord, but to protect the reputation of the Lord. He says, now I'm going to have to do this. I speak in this confidence of boasting, seeing that many glory, verse 18, after the flesh, you're into fleshly credentials and glorying. You're into that kind of stuff. So here I go. I will glory also. For you suffer fools gladly, seeing yourselves are wise. Ooh, it drips. It drips with, well, he's just, you're so wise, he's saying. He's being facetious. For you suffer or receive if a man bring you into bondage, if he devour you, if a man take of you, if a man exalt himself, if a man smite you on the face. But when I speak, verse 21, it is as a reproach, as though we had been weak. Now, there were those that were coming on the scene that were charging these people, like we talked about in our study previously. Ludicrous amounts of money to bring their teachings. And they would put heavy trips on the people. And they would devour them and burden them and scream at them. And these actually followed what was a rabbinical tradition in that time They would smite him in the face, literally. And the guys that were there said, oh, this is wonderful. See, in rabbinical times, teaching during this time, and it still happens in some circles, if the student does not agree with the teacher or is not listening or doesn't get it, he will strike him in the face. And you see, these guys were coming to the church there and they were devouring and burdening and making them feel terrible and hitting them in the face. And Paul says, and you love it. And as I've said before, it's a real mystery to me how often Christians are so blessed when somebody comes and screams at them, puts trips on them, tells them they're doing terrible, puts burdens and expectations and pressures, and they go, oh, wasn't that a wonderful meeting? But if somebody comes and just teaches the Scriptures and just gives the counsel of God and talks about the goodness of the Lord, so often people say, well, that just wasn't anointed. That wasn't powerful. We want to be beaten. Beat us. Beat us, teacher. Beat us, pastor. Beat us, speaker. Beat us. It's spiritual sadism. And I believe that it's because people basically feel sort of guilty all the time. I don't pray enough. I don't do this. I don't do that. So I need to go to church and have somebody beat me. Oh, that's wonderful. But it said concerning Jesus Christ that he would not bruise the broken reed. The reed that was flopping down. He wasn't saying, okay, you're flopping down. Whack! Stomp. And he wouldn't quench the smoking flax. That is, the wick that was just sort of puffing and not really igniting. Oh yeah? Well, here's some cold water. That wasn't the ministry or the manner of Jesus Christ. And Paul here says, now when these guys come on the scene, they put you in bondage, they devour you, they smite you in the face, and you receive it. But when I come, verse 21, you think I'm weak. Howbeit, wherein soever any is bold. I speak foolishly. Oh, I'm embarrassed to say this. But I am bold. Are they Hebrews? And here we see that these that were going about trying to undo what Paul was bringing forth were evidently Jewish teachers coming to the Christians and saying, now, hey, this Gracie agape stuff lacks substance. There's more to it than that. You need to be not just believers in Jesus, but you must be embracers of Judaism, legalism, ritualism, regulations. And I understand that. It appeals to me. That is my flesh. I would love to wear a prayer shawl, quite frankly. I could get into the whole thing very easily. The black outfits, never have to worry about what to wear. You just have two outfits there. And I'm not saying that to put people down. I'm saying that to say there's a tendency within me. There's a tendency within people to want to go back into legalism or ritualism or rules and regulations. It appeals to a part of our flesh. And that's why Jesus was so radical. Because he walked around as a common person. And he didn't do all their traditional washings and ceremonies and rituals. And they couldn't figure it out. He's a glutton. He's a wine bibber. Look who he hangs out with. Look at how he teaches in such simplicity with these little parables. And there were those in Corinth that were being told, hey, it's not so simple. And they were buying it. And Paul says, are they Hebrews? Hey, so am I. I'm a Hebrew too, man. I'm a Jew. Don't let them put that trip on you. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? Well, so am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. Who? They talk about being servants of Christ with their Jewish credentials, their rules and rituals. Hey, I am more. Why? In labors more abundant, I work. In stripes above measure, we're talking about beating, caning, to use the phrase of the day. In prison, more frequently, in deaths often. I'm at the point of death constantly. Of the Jews, 5 times received I 40 stripes, save one. I was beaten 5 times with 39 lashes, and that would often kill a man, one beating of 39 lashes. But Paul said, I've gone through it 5 times. Thrice I was beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day I have been in the open sea, in the deep. Man, I complain when my waterbed springs a leak. This guy amazes me. The work of the Lord in Paul, I just am dumbfounded when I really think about it. 3 times shipwrecked. By the way, this was written before Acts chapter 20, before the one shipwreck that we have record of. So all these things that he's talking about, only a handful are mentioned in the book of Acts, which shows us that Acts is only a sketch of what Paul was going through, what was coming down on him. Most of these things aren't mentioned in the book of Acts, and these things happened before things got really heavy in his life. When he wrote this, it hadn't even gotten that heavy yet. It got heavier for our brother Paul. At this point, though, he says, well, I've been beaten 5 times with 39 lashes, striped in prison at the point of death, stoned, beaten with rods, 3 times on a shipwreck, a night and a day in the open sea, in journeyings often, verse 26, in perils of water, which means trying to ford rivers, in perils of robbers, in perils by my own countrymen. My own countrymen were out to kill me. In perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils amongst false brethren. Verse 27, in weariness and painfulness, in watchings often, in hunger, in thirst, in fasting, in cold, in nakedness. All these things are happening to me, and you say I'm weak. And these guys claim that they're the heavy-duty spiritual leaders. I'm more. Listen to my story. And then here's the clincher. Besides those things that are without, those things that have happened to me externally, the shipwrecks and the stonings and the beatings and the robberies, the muggings, besides those things, that which cometh upon me daily, the care of all the churches. Now, when Paul says besides those things, he's saying, that's beside the point. That's nothing. So I get beat all the time. So they throw rocks at me. So they're out to kill me constantly. So I'm hungry a lot. So I'm cold at night. So I'm in jail wherever I go. That's nothing. What really is the pressure on me is I care so much about the churches. That's where the real pressure is for me. That's not the heart of a spiritual guru or a professional motivational speaker. That's the heart of a father. Now, dads, you know something of this. As tough as things can be externally or financially or even physically, it's nothing in comparison to what you feel for your son, for your daughter. You want them to do well. I look at my kids and I want them to do well. I want them to make it. I want them to be happy and successful in the Lord and saved eternally. That's where the pressure is. Now, every one of you who is a dad understands that. And that's what Paul is saying here as he's relating this heart of a father. He's saying all this external stuff, as heavy as that might seem, it's besides the point. It's not the issue. It's what I feel in my heart for you people. So when I say the anxiety that Paul felt as this proof of his fatherly heart, I think you can feel the vibe a bit and understand his point. He cares. Besides all these things, more than all those things, it's the care of the church. Now, I ask you tonight, I raise this question to you and me. What made this guy tick? Would you take 39 lashes 5 times for the people sitting next to you? Oh, not the ones married to you or related with you in family. I mean, just the Christian body. What makes this guy tick? As I read this chapter, I'm impacted greatly. I say, that is, Lord, the way it should be. What's wrong with me? And as I ponder this, I'm convinced in my own thinking and praying and studying, and you can see if these things be true from your perspective too. I think there are 3 things that Paul brings up in this epistle that makes him this kind of a man. First of all, number 1, the reality of eternity. The reality of eternity. He'll get into that in chapter 12. Paul went up to heaven. He was there. He looked around. He knew it was true. It wasn't just some foggy, fuzzy ideal or pie in the sky in the sweet by and by. He knew, hey, life is short, and all that matters ultimately is where a person is going to spend eternity, the reality of eternity. News Today came out with a story that they now know, or are strongly convinced of, one of the carcinogenic influences that bring about breast cancer in women is electricity. So women that are working at computers or around microwave ovens or vacuum cleaners or around TV sets, they're now saying, hey, electricity. And the government is scrambling now to try and figure out, well, what can we do about this now? You know, how can we bring protection? Let me tell you something, gang. Life is fatal. I have news for you. Listen carefully. You're going to die. Unless the rapture happens. But apart from the rapture in your lifetime, every one of you is going to die. These reports on electricity should not shock you. I just love to do that. I get a big charge out of it. Sorry. These reports shouldn't shock you, truly. They shouldn't go, oh no, oh no. You're going to die. Right now, there are forces at work destroying your physical being. The moment you're born, you begin to die. Now, you go, I know that. Really? Then why do we scramble so hard to deny it? Or protect ourselves from it? The fact of the matter is, you're going to die. But I exercise. I exercise. Good. But you know what? Interesting. Stanford University about 8 months ago came out with a most interesting study. Exercise at the best. At the best. For every minute you put in your aerobics class or in the weight room or whatever you might do for exercise, every minute that you put in will increase the length of your life an equal minute. Think about it. So you spend 10,000 hours in the weight room, 10,000 hours on the jogging track, 10,000 hours doing aerobics, and you gain, theoretically, 10,000 hours, perhaps, to a certain point. But you lost it because you spent your time in the gym. It's a wash. So all you're really doing is spending the best years of your life in a sweaty gym. Go fishing. Have a burger. Because at the very best, you're just transferring time so that you can be older longer. That's all you're doing. You're wasting your youth so you can be older in a rest home longer. Think about it. It's insanity. Well, John, are you arguing against exercise? No. Paul the Apostle tells Timothy, his young protege, that bodily exercise profits a little. There's a little profit in it. But when you put it in the scope of eternity, hey, it's not going to help you. Now, Paul knew the reality of eternity. And all he says is, I care about getting everybody I can there. Has the Lord ever really made heaven real to your heart? Let me ask you this. Has he ever made hell real to your heart? Have you ever just stopped and looked at a crowd of people or been at a family reunion or looked out at your classmates or your colleagues and just stopped and said, they're going to hell? My aunt, my nephew, my 18-year-old daughter, my great-grandmother, my neighbor, they're going to hell unless they receive the free gift of salvation that God has so generously provided for them. See, Paul knew the reality of eternity, and he said, hey, all that matters for me, let them beat me. Let them stone me. Let them imprison me. Let them make fun of me. But I know the reality of eternity. So those things don't bother me. The second thing Paul knew, not only the reality of eternity, but secondly, as I think about Paul and consider this man, the second thing he knew was the potency of the gospel. The potency of the gospel. What do you mean? He told the Romans, he said directly, chapter 1, right around verse 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, because it is the what? Power of God unto salvation. To every man that believeth, Jew or Gentile. I'm not ashamed. I'll go about everywhere taking any opportunity to share, because I'm convinced that it is the power of God unto salvation. Now, Bible students, that word salvation, as you probably know by this point, means more than just being born again. It's that word sozo, the full orb of God's blessing. I know that the gospel, the good news of Christ, is the power of God unto salvation. That people will be not only ushered into heaven eternally, but they'll be blessed and helped and saved in their family life, in their perspective about life, in the troubles that they go through, in the dilemmas that they deal with, in the hassles that come their way. Hey, I know this. I'm not ashamed of the good news. What is the good news? That Jesus Christ died for their sin, paid the price, was buried, rose again on the third day, 1 Corinthians chapter 15. That He died for their sin, and now He's risen again, and He will see anyone through. What if you really believe that? What if we really believe that the person who is just so miserable in the office that we work in, or that friend of yours that's in the hospital with depression, two north, or that marriage down the street that's blowing up. What if, like Paul, we knew the potency of the gospel? It's not trying to get people straightened out through counseling. It's not trying to unravel their problems by our hours of dialoguing. But we say, I know the gospel. It is the power of God unto salvation. This is the thing. Jesus Christ died for your sin. He rose again. He's here for you. And He will see you through. You see, this is huge. This is really huge, gang. The key to being a man of faith is not developing your faith as such. It's simply seeing the faithfulness of God. The older I get, the longer I walk, the more I realize singularly that's the key. When people come down by the scores on Sunday, do I have confidence in what I'm going to share with them before I dunk them in the water, that somehow the profundity of my word or the anointing on my life is somehow going to see them through? No way. My stomach is rumbling. I can't wait for lunch. I feel bad about what I just shared. It didn't come across in the way that I hoped it would. I can't believe that Hopkins sang what he sang, and I just kept wrestling with that too, you see. But this I know, that every person who comes is going to be met by the Lord, not because of who I am, but because of who He is. He is faithful. I know that. I know it as sure as my name is Jonathan Corson. I know it. I know that the Lord will make Himself known and real to anyone who comes to Him with any degree of sincerity. I know Jesus. I know my Father. And I know that He will in no wise cast out any. And I know that He is going to be there with them. That as they drive home, He's going to be touching their hearts. That as they lay their head on the pillow that night, the Lord is going to be whispering in their ear. I know the Lord, you see. Now, does that mean that we don't take any sort of responsibility? No, He gives us that privilege if we want to be used in that way of helping people. Glorious privilege, but He doesn't need me. He's real and living, and He's not dependent upon me. Paul knew that. He knew the reality of eternity, number one, the potency of the gospel. Hey, it's the power of God. Just believing that Jesus died for your sin and rose again, that is going to change your life. And number three, he knew the mystery of God's mercy. In 2 Corinthians 5, don't turn there, the hour's getting late, but in chapter 5, verse 14, Paul said, concerning his own ministry, it's the love of Christ that constrains me. That's what moved Paul. That's why he would absorb the beatings, put up with the prisons, and most of all, care about the people. It's the love of Christ. Now, what does that mean? The love that Christ has shown me. The mystery of His mercy towards me. I was a blasphemer. I was a persecutor. I was an enemy of those that claimed to be Christians, you see. But the Lord stopped me in my tracks. He knocked me to the ground. He shined a light upon me. He called out to me, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? Who art thou, Lord? I said, I am Christ. I am Jesus whom thou persecutest. Is it not hard for you to kick against the goads? And Paul said, oh Lord, what do you want me to do? And Paul realized, man, how merciful the Lord has been to me. Paul would say, I am the chiefest of sinners. That's not false humility. He viewed himself that way. I can't believe it. I'm the chiefest of sinners, but the Lord has saved me and He's using me and He makes Himself known to me and He works through me. It's the love of Christ, Christ's love for me that constrains me. That's why I do what I do, Paul said, you see. And I believe, personally, that to the degree that anyone in this sanctuary, any sister, any brother in the Applegate family, understands the reality of eternity, heaven and hell, life is short. The potency of the gospel, it's real. He'll change people. And the mystery of His mercy towards me, it's the love of Christ that constrains me. To the degree that I understand those three things that Paul talks about to the Corinthian church, is the degree that I will also say I'm going for it, recklessly, wholeheartedly, whatever the cost might be. And to the degree that these things are fuzzy or theoretical or just theology, if that's the case, then I'm not going to be persevering when the times get a little bit tough. I'm not going to be pressed to share with the person that I bump into seemingly serendipitously. To the degree that I understand these things will be to the degree that I am like Paul. Now you say, John, okay, but how in the world then does one understand these things in that way? I suggest to you a very simple secret. Not easy, but simple. I suggest to you, for your thinking, that if I want to be like Paul, if I want to be like Jeremiah, who wept over Jerusalem and wrote the book of Lamentations when he saw the city going up in smoke, and he wept and he lamented, he cared about the people. If I want to be like Jesus, who's sitting on the same hillside as did Jeremiah, 600 years later, also looked at the same city and wept, "Oh, Jerusalem, I would gather you under my wings as a mother hen gathers her chicks, but you wouldn't let me." And he wept compassionately. How does one get that kind of compassion? And let me ask you this before I suggest an answer to that question. In Revelation 21, it talks about Jesus coming and wiping away the tears from men's eyes and saying there's no more sorrow, no more sickness, no more death, no more trouble. What's he speaking of? I suggest to you, for your thinking, that he very likely is talking about people that are crying, not about their own condition. "Oh, I had the gout, or I had dandruff, or I was only in the top 3% of people in the world in richness," which all of you are, by the way. I suggest to you that the tears that Jesus wipes away are not those that are crying for themselves, but it's those like Paul, like Jeremiah, who were weeping over the condition of a lost, damned humanity, who were weeping over the needless depression, over the results of depravity, who were weeping because they read the news and they looked at people and they listened to stories and they wept because they said, "Oh, how long, Lord," as they're crying in heaven. People that cared not for their own condition as much as what they see around them. And Jesus will come and wipe those tears away. How will it be when I stand before Him? That's what I'm pondering today. Will I have dry eyes in heaven? Whoopee! Here I am, Lord. Oh, Johnny. Yep, here you are. While others come in with wet eyes, red eyes, because they cared, really cared. Honestly, if you died tonight, would Jesus show up and say, "Let me wipe away your tears"? How you cared. You cared like Jeremiah. You cared like Paul. You cared like me, you see. Lord, I don't. I want to. I know that I should. But Lord, why don't I? Simple answer, at least for me. Compassion is the result of contemplation. Jesus sat on the hillside. He looked at the city. And as he looked at the city, he felt compassion within him and he wept for them. Jeremiah sat on the hillside and he studied and he sat there day after week after month and he realized the condition, the destruction, the sorrow, the sadness, you see. We're too busy. That's it. We never sit. We never park our car and watch cars go onto the freeway. Car after car after car as they get on the freeway or go down the roadway in a hurry. Where are they going? They're leaving their homes early in the morning to get on the street, to go to work, to draw up their plans architecturally or to raise the money governmentally to build roads and bridges, to do what? To get to work on. Wait a minute. They're driving to go to work, to build bridges, to go to work. And you can play that through in any situation. You go, wait a minute, this is really crazy. It's a treadmill. It's a merry-go-round without the merry. And all these people are on it. And you walk through your neighborhood in the morning hour and you go house by house and you can hear, if you listen carefully, parents yelling at their kids. Wives and husbands angrily parting from each other. Frustration and tension. You can see people get in their car if you're up early in the morning with a cigarette in their mouth and a grimace on their face and they're on their way for another big day. What happens? Your heart begins to break. You start to say, wow, they're really lost. I really believe this, that I am oftentimes, far too often, just too busy. I need to listen and sit and look and hear and think and contemplate. And when I contemplate, I find my heart filling with compassion. When I fail contemplation, I lose all compassion. I'm just caught up in the same treadmill that society is caught up in. Take time. Go to the cemetery, the Jacksonville Cemetery. Sit up there. There's some great spots. Contemplate these people were once down there running stores, raising kids. Now they're up here. Look out over the valley. Watch people driving, jostling in the traffic. Doing what? Going where? And I betcha, you'll find like I'm finding. Your eyes begin to moisten a bit. You begin to ponder and wonder. Poor people. Lost. Contemplation breeds, fosters compassion. Lack of contemplation leads to callousness. You don't even notice. When I suggest to you folks over and over, week after week, month after month, to have devotional times in the morning, in the evening, it's not to earn brownie points. God loves you. If you have 5-hour devotions every day, or if you have 5 minutes of devotions once a year, His love for you is the same. But if you fail to have devotions, if I fail to stop and sit and think and pray and journal and listen and worship. When I fail to do that, my eyes get dry. Paul cared. One more verse and we're done. Who is weak? Verse 29. Who is hurting? And am I not hurting? Who is offended? And I am not burning? When you're hurting, Paul says, as a father would, I hurt. When you're offended, I'm burning hot with the person who offended you. That is, the person who stumbled you. When somebody has stumbled you in your walk, I'm angry with that person. The heart of a father. The heart of a mature believer. Well, if I must glory, and we'll talk about what he will glory in, if he must, in our study next time. Let's stand.